Hard Feelings by Mark Coggins is a bang bang thrill ride, says best-selling author Seth Harwood, who adds that the lead character of Winnie is a female Jack Reacher. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 13. Reardon. We settled on Winnie's Lincoln for the trip. It wasn't the least conspicuous car on the road, but it stuck out less than my Galaxy and was presumably more reliable. I did the driving, and I did it in one gulp. We started at 6 in the morning, 2 days after our adventure at the hotel, taking the duffel bag of weapons and drugs we'd confiscated from the winemaker's men, Ray's RF shield and decoy transmitter, and a final bit of electronic wizardry he had cooked up for us when it became clear where we were going and what we might find.
"Electronic countermeasures," he called it.
To me and every other schmo without a PhD in electrical engineering, it looked like an old-school flip phone made for senior citizens or people uncomfortable with technology. It looked exactly like mine, in fact. We took I-10 out of town and latched onto US 395, the road that would take us through the Sierra Nevada over some of the highest passes in California to our stopping point for the night, Reno. Winnie showed little interest in our conversation or the spectacular scenery, opting instead to spend her time building hand strength and dexterity by working obsessively with a set of space-age exercisers the likes of which I'd never seen. The strangest one was a kind of half-glove with retractable cords that sprouted from the palm and went to each finger to exercise the muscles that opened the hand rather than closed it. Around Mono Lake, Winnie finally set her collection of torture devices aside and turned to look at me. "What?" I said, more than a little perturbed by the sudden attention.
"How did you know that the Bridal Bit Ranch was a whorehouse?"
It was a question I'd been dreading ever since we'd confirmed my hunch by Googling the name on Ray's computer. I'd hoped the excitement of the discovery was enough to push any curiosity about the source out of her mind. "It's not a whorehouse exactly," I said. "It's a legally licensed brothel."
"You know what I mean. How did you know it was a place where men go to pay for sex?"
"I've never been there."
"The question stands."
I pressed the accelerator to pass a wheezing VW microbus I'd been content to follow up until now, but it was easier to run away from the bus than the question. "Look," I said, "I might possibly have made a trip to the area to patronize a similar establishment, and during that trip, I might possibly have heard about the Bridal Bit."
"You and Ray went, didn't you?"
"I'd rather not say."
"You don't need to, the way he turned beet red when the topic came up."
"He has problems with flushing."
"The hell he does. What did you hear about this place?"
I squeezed the wheel. This was exactly the line of questioning I wanted to avoid. "Not a lot. I talked about it with a guy I met at the bar of the other establishment. He said the Bridal Bit girls were very attractive, and that they were very expensive, more than double the going rate. He also said that..."
"What?"
"Well, I didn't understand at the time, but he said that while the girls seemed very enthusiastic about their work, their performance was a bit scripted. In fact, he went back a second time and asked for the same girl. She didn't recognize him from before and said almost exactly the same things. It was almost like she was...
programmed?
Yeah, that was the word he used. She picked up one of her hand grips and snapped it closed a few inches from my face.
"It's not so hard to understand now, is it?"
"No, I guess not." I tried to steer the conversation to the winemaker and whether we were going to find him at the brothel, but she wasn't having it. She screwed the earbuds of an MP3 player into her head and went back to her exercises. Stopping only for lunch at Astroga's and Bishop, and several times to fill the thirsty Lincoln, we covered the distance to Reno in a little more than 12 hours. Winnie maintained strict radio silence the whole way. By the time we passed the famous neon sign at the entrance to downtown, I was so tired of stewing in my own juices that I tried to kickstart things by reading the sign aloud. "Reno," I announced, "the biggest little city in the world." Winnie snorted. "The biggest little boil on the ass of the world is more like it." "Are you going to be like this from now on?" "Like what?" "This is me. Get over it." "I think you're still pissed about the brothel business." "I'm sorry, but we wouldn't know about the bridal bit if I hadn't happened to do some first-hand research."
"First of all, I don't give a flying fuck what you do in your personal life. We aren't going to the senior prom. We're trying to stop the winemaker. Second, we found out what we needed to know from frigging Google. So even if we didn't have the benefit of your so-called research, we would still be exactly where we are now."
"Whatever," I said, and gestured at the pile of 1970s concrete to my right. "Circus Circus okay with you? It's cheap and the rooms are clean."
"Why not? Clown partner. Clown hotel."
I made a growling noise in my throat and started to say something really nasty. I settled for, "It's a pleasure working with you, too." We checked into rooms on the same floor, and I proceeded downstairs for the $13.99 prime rib dinner and a $50 fleecing at the casino blackjack tables. Winnie informed me in monosyllables that we would meet at 10 the following morning and chose to dine alone in her room. Later, as I lay in bed thinking about our plans for the next day, I realized that she was probably just as angry about what I was going to do tomorrow as she was about what I had already done. We got underway at 11, driving east out of town through Reno's sister city of Sparks, along Interstate 80 for about 15 miles until we found the exit for Cottonwood Canyon Road. There weren't any cottonwoods around that I could see, just a lot of red dirt and high desert scrub. The road led to the base of some red dirt foothills where the Bridal Bit Ranch was nestled in a U-shaped notch in the terrain. But before we got onto the grounds, we had to pass through a gate with a guardhouse. The guard was a lean, ropey-looking guy with a cowboy hat and a horseshoe mustache. He poked his head out of the guardhouse, taking in me and the car. Winnie, he would have needed X-ray vision to take in because she was hidden in the trunk, wearing Ray's RF shield and packing the sawed-off shotgun and two of the 9mm automatics. She might have had one of the tasers, too.
"Picking up?" said the guard.
"Excuse me?
Are you here to pick up someone?"
"Oh," I said. "You mean because of the Lincoln? No, I'm here for myself." The guard gave me a wide, if completely phony, grin.
"Well, have a good time, then. Please park near the entrance in one of the designated spots. Starlet will meet you at the door."
I nodded and pulled the car forward across a surprisingly ample and nearly empty parking lot to the main building. It looked like an overgrown Motel 6, trying hard to be an Italian villa, but there was a limit to what pink stucco and red roof tile could accomplish. The structure was T-shaped, and we knew from Google Maps, had a pool and an outbuilding in back. We also knew that there was another gate barring access to the rear, so for all practical purposes, the front door was our only way in. I parked as close to the entrance as possible to minimize the ground Winnie would have to cover when she emerged from the trunk. My presence had obviously been telegraphed to the inhabitants by the guard, because a blonde woman wearing leopard skin hot pants and a gauzy black blouse greeted me the moment I walked through the door.
"Hello, cowboy," she said. "I'm..."
"Starlet," I suggested. She giggled. That's right. Welcome to the Brattlebit Ranch. I got some friends who are dying to meet you.
This, I knew from previous experience, was the preamble for the lineup, a ritual where all the available girls in the house were paraded in front of a customer for him to select one, or if he was so inclined, more. The first and only other time I'd been to a brothel, Ray had told me not to make a selection during the lineup.
If you jump at a girl then, he counseled, it makes it twice as hard to negotiate price. Have a drink at the bar first and spend some time getting to know the girls. Then pick one. You'll be bargaining from a stronger position.
While Ray's advice might have been sage under normal circumstances, I wasn't at all eager to prolong the process today, particularly with Winnie baking away in the trunk. I let Starlet lead me over to a leather wingback chair in the center of the room, just in front of a little stage or platform. A rustic-looking bar was off to the left, and behind it stood a guy with his hair slicked back and parted in the middle. He wore an old-timey bartender's getup, right down to the vest and arm garters. He smiled and nodded at me while rubbing a beer glass with a rag. There wasn't anyone else in the room. The customers who came in the few cars in the lot must have made their selections and moved to the back. That much of our plan was working. Winnie and I hoped by coming early we would limit the number of civilians caught in the crossfire. Starlet clapped her hands. A curtain at the right parted and an obvious bouncer stepped through and held the red velvet back with a club-like arm. Following him was a line of women who could have come straight from the stage of the Miss Universe contest. They were all different races and had different hair colors, skin tones, and heights, but they were all arrestingly beautiful. The women in the first brothel I had visited had been attractive enough, but theirs was a pedestrian kind of beauty. If you'd seen the same group in green aprons working behind the counter at Starbucks, you wouldn't have given them a second thought. If I'd seen even one of these women at a Starbucks, I'd have made it my mission to camp out at the store ordering double espressos for as long as she was on shift. They were different in other respects, too. The women at the first brothel were looser and more outgoing, winking and flipping their hair when they came up to us, infusing their speech with innuendo and invitation. As these women filed onto the little platform to introduce themselves, they were poised and formal, almost as if they were competing in a beauty contest. Each held her face in a fixed smile, and each limited her greeting to a solemn and toneless, "Hello, I'm so-and-so." When all of them had their turn on the platform and had assembled off to the side in a too perfect line, Starlet came up to caress the back of my neck and purr, "Well, partner, who do you like?" While I didn't want to linger on the decision for all sorts of reasons, I realized in a panic that I didn't have any basis for making it. Picking the one I liked best would be the worst thing to do. It was wildly inappropriate, and it would only piss off Winnie more. Then it dawned on me that it didn't matter. Winnie would assume I had picked my favorite, whomever I chose. "The first," I blurted. At least I could blame my selection on the random order of the lineup.
"You mean Destiny," said Starlet.
"Yes, I guess I do." Destiny had short black hair cut in a bob that curled just under her chin. Her eyes were dark and rimmed with kohl, and her skin had a hint of olive to it, making me think she was at least part Middle Eastern. She didn't acknowledge her selection, but walked serenely off to the left down a corridor that opened beside the bar. The other women retraced their steps through the curtained doorway. "Isn't she going to wait for me?" I asked.
"We do things a little differently at the bridal bit," said Starlet. "We don't like to burden our girls with the business side of things. You and I are going to an anteroom where we can talk service and price and get you checked out. Destiny will be getting ready to show you a wonderful time."
She beamed down at me, apparently waiting for me to acknowledge the information. "That's swell," I said, sounding like a perfect moron, even to myself.
Starlet led me down the same corridor that Destiny had taken and pulled open the second door on the left. Inside was a small room with a gold-trimmed daybed and chair that was done up with statues, paintings, and gold-trimmed curtains like Donald Trump's version of Julius Caesar's mudroom. A closed door that presumably led to the bedroom was at the back. Starlet gestured for me to sit on the daybed and pulled up the chair just a few inches away. Floral perfume that was about as subtle as a roach bomb wafted over me. She crossed her legs and tugged at the hems of her hot pants, complaining, "These things are always creeping up around your waist." She winked and relaxed back into her chair. "So, what kind of party did you have in mind?" I cleared my throat. "I'm a simple guy. I was just looking for plain vanilla sex." "Just an old-fashioned screw, eh? No problem. Destiny can scratch that itch for you." Starlet tittered and then stopped abruptly. "That'll run you $1,200 for 30 minutes. $1,200? I wasn't here to bargain, but I doubted anyone paid that without at least a little pushback. Starlet's voice lost the facade of forced cheeriness. "Listen, cowboy, the bridal bit is a special place. The girls are the most beautiful in Nevada. In the world, maybe. And quality costs." She put a bit of honey back into her voice. "But I think you'll find it's worth it." I nodded. "Okay." "Excellent. Cash or credit card?" I had $2,000 and a money clip in my front pocket next to Ray's phony cell phone. I pulled out the clip and counted off the bills. Starlet snatched them up and walked them over to a small desk, where she fed them into a slit in a heavy metal box in a lower drawer. From another drawer, she took a pair of rubber gloves and tugged them on. She turned back to me when she was ready and held her arms wide open. "All right, time for the pecker check. Stand and drop your pants, big boy." I knew this was coming, but that didn't make it any less humiliating. A visual inspection for sexually transmitted diseases was standard procedure at Nevada brothels. While I couldn't argue with the rationale for the policy, it had been the thing that made me swear off brothels forever after my last trip. The whole experience was tawdry enough without including a USDA sausage inspection. I stood and dropped trow. Starlet approached and gave me a thorough once-over, pinching and pulling at will. "Oh," she cooed, "you're going to make a certain someone very happy." If Winnie and I were right about the bridal bit, that was certainly true, but not in the way Starlet meant. "I bet you say that to all the boys," I told her. "Nah, you got a great package." She tapped me on the hip and started pulling off the gloves. "You can zip up, but one last thing, no weapons of any sort are allowed in the boudoir, including knives. You look like you're traveling light, but I have to check. This is Nevada, after all." I was traveling light, just jeans and a t-shirt. I yanked up my pants and then turned out my hip pockets, displaying the meager contents of keys, money clip, and fake cell phone. She smiled. "Looks like you got a bit more cash if you'd like to go another round. How about your back pockets?" I turned so she could pat them. "Nothing on your ankles?" I often carry a knife on my ankle, so it wasn't an idle question. This time, I'd reluctantly agreed to leave all the weaponry to Winnie. I hitched my pants legs up to show off pasty shins and wrinkled black socks. "Cool. Then I guess it's time for you to step through that door and meet your destiny." Bet you never used that line before. She brought her hand up to her mouth to cover a near snort. "Sorry, I couldn't help myself." I yanked open the door. Inside was a larger room with more faux Roman furnishings. A four-poster bed made with Corinthian columns and a drooping silk canopy dominated the space. A pair of Venus de Milo statues with Beverly Hills boob jobs flanked that, and gilded mirrors shimmered from the ceiling and the wall behind. The only light came from a chandelier with twinkling little bulbs. Destiny lay on the bed with her hands clasped behind her head. She was naked and as glistening as polished river stone. "Climb aboard," she urged. "The train is about to leave the station." I stepped across the threshold and the door closed behind me. Everything hinged on what I was about to find out now. I went to where she lay and reached down to touch the back of her neck. She didn't attempt to stop me, didn't even shift her position. When I felt what I was looking for, I pulled my hand back and sat next to Destiny. As we anticipated, she, and presumably all the girls at the brothel, had a stimulator surgically implanted at the base of her brain, just where it joined the spine. I didn't begin to understand the science, but I knew from my last run-in with a winemaker that the stimulator overrode all motor impulses, replacing them with commands received from a radio transmitter, rather than restoring self-directed mobility as Winnie's version of the technology did. It turned the bearer into an electronic puppet. "Listen," I said in a hushed tone, "I know you're not doing this willingly. I have something I believe will break their control, but if it works, I need you to stay calm and do what I say." "Shy, aren't you?" she said, as if she hadn't heard a word I'd said. "Well, quit your grinning and drop your linen." Realizing there wasn't any point in talking further, I reached into my pocket and took out Ray's electronic gizmo. I powered it on as he taught me and immediately saw a green LED indicating a transmission in the area. I pressed the number 9 on the keypad and a red LED began blinking as well. That meant the transmission was being jammed, and it also meant that an alert had been sent to the companion device Winnie was carrying. Game on. If I expected an abrupt change in Destiny once the signal controlling her movements was interrupted, I was disappointed. Freed of electronic slavery, she merely lowered her arms and stared at her reflection in the ceiling mirror, her mouth gaping slightly. Others had a more animated response. "Get the fuck off me, you fat pig!" I heard a woman scream from next door. Then came the boom of a shotgun, followed by two more booms in quick succession. "It's her!" shouted a panicked male from the front of the building. "Watch out!" I heard answering shots from a handgun, and then the door flew open. I figured the winemaker's men would be monitoring the women by hidden video, but I didn't think they would identify the source of the jamming so quickly. The bartender with the slick back hair peered around the doorframe and aimed a revolver in our direction. Squeezed the trigger. The mirror behind us evaporated in a cloud of sparkling shards, and I pulled Destiny and half the covers from the bed to the floor. The bartender advanced into the room, firing indiscriminately as he came. He took the shoulder off one of the Venus de Milos and put another slug in the floor less than an inch from my outstretched foot as I struggled to drag Destiny and myself further under the bed. "Winnie!" I shouted. "A little..." Help was the word I wanted, but I never got it out. A shotgun convulsed, very loud and very close. The bartender made a noise like tenement plumbing and fell to the floor with a wet smack. From under the bed, I saw a pair of running shoes approach, and then Winnie leaned down to find Destiny and me tangled in a wad of silk sheets. She unholstered one of the 9mm automatics and slid it across the floor. "Quit fucking around," she snapped, "and get to work." You have been listening to No Hard Feelings, a finalist for the Forward Reviews Book of the Year Award. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.